Hello and welcome to the Secrets of Storytellers. We're talking about office politics today. Quite an interesting topic, I think. Have you ever been a victim, or have you played it yourself? Or have you ever heard any individual say their office doesn't have politics at work? Unlikely. So whenever two or more people work together in an environment, and all of them are in some ways fighting together to make the pie bigger, and yet fighting against each other to get a bigger share of the same pie, politics is an obvious outcome. It is inevitable, and Nevin's book is so aptly titled as "If You Don't Do Politics, Politics Will Do You." Nevin Postma has worked with multiple organizations across domains and industries, including being the CEO of Business Women's Association and many others. She now runs her consulting firm Nevin Postma Inc., which is a leadership, culture, and strategy facilitator for organizations around the world. She has penned down the book with the intent of dealing with the office politics, since as a normal human behavior, we tend to neglect what we don't like and ignore its presence. And neglecting office politics can be severe for your careers. Well, a disclaimer that Nevin also starts her book with, you can navigate office politics effectively and ethically, and yes, it is really possible. The real question today as well, if we can do that or not, and the discussion will help us go deep down on that topic. So let's welcome Nevin. Hi Nevin, welcome to the Secrets of Storytellers. How are you?
I am so well and delighted to be on the podcast. Thank you.
Thank you. Great to have you here and to be discussing such an interesting topic of politics, because you know, it's fun to play and it's not so fun to be a victim of it, I think.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the perspective always depends on where you sit. I had a wonderful comment on one of my posts on LinkedIn from a chap who I don't know and may never meet. And he said he was given some wonderful advice at the beginning of his career. And this person said, if it works for you, well, then it's strategy. If it works against you, no, well, then it's politics. Of course, it's the same thing, but it's about the perspective and whether you're on the winning side or the losing side.
Right. Yeah, I agree. I think with the book, what you've tried to do is bring objectivity into the game of the ever subjective topic of politics, and quite well at that. I loved going through the book. I loved each and every part of it. In fact, I loved the hitman story also. Do you mind we start with that?
Not at all. So I was running a not-for-profit in South Africa in the early 2000s. And we had a real HIV/AIDS crisis running rampant through the country. So we had almost 1 million children who were left orphaned and vulnerable by HIV/AIDS. And so the NGO that I was working with and running, we had about 100 projects across the country in deep rural areas. I suppose very similarly to India, you know, South Africa is a country of vast differences and extremes. And so the cities are first world and 21st century, the deep rural areas can feel like parallel centuries and parallel universes. And of course, there was a lot in this work that was incredibly rewarding and fulfilling. But particularly because of the nature of the communities that we were working with and in, very poor people with very few options. When we established a project in an area, there were a lot of people clamoring to try to get a role there, a job of any kind. Mm-hmm. And in this one project in one part of South Africa that's got quite a violent political history, we had established a project. We had appointed a few people to that project, you know, a project manager and some childminders and a cook and what have you. And off it went. And I was sitting in our head office in Johannesburg, which is like any modern city. Mm-hmm. At my laptop, and the next thing the phone rang and the call got put through to me, and it was the project manager from this project. So I'm like, hi, how are you? How's it going? Right. Are you guys settling in and getting going? Nevin, I can't talk right now. Nevin, we've had a huge problem here. So of course, this gets my full attention as the CEO. I'm thinking, what on earth is the problem? And essentially what had happened was there was a person who had been hired to be the cook for this project. Uh-huh. And a pittance of a salary, but in that part of the country, of course, even a pittance means something.
Right.
And the person who did not get hired was so unimpressed and so irritated and so determined to get her rival out of the way that she hired an assassin to come and kill the cook.
God.
The assassin pitches up and takes one look at the cook that he's supposed to kill and realizes that this woman is his cousin. So then does not kill her.
Okay.
And, you know, I remember sitting in my office thinking, what? I mean, where does a situation like this fit in any standard operating procedure?
Yeah.
And once I got my head around it and we'd calmed the situation down and I realized that nobody had come to any harm, then, and I must say, I think for years afterwards, I have really wondered, how did they react the next time they went to a family function, you know, like granny's birthday?
Yeah.
And she asked him, so how's work, you know, as a hitman? It was just astonishing.
Right. So, you know, there's a beautiful message that you have also put along the story. And while the story is really interesting, there's a deeper message that you have put along. Could you please share that for us?
Yeah, well, I suppose it's very similar to what you said in your introduction. You know, organizations are not democracies, they're power struggles.
Hmm.
They're power struggles for finite resources. And so this wasn't an organization, it was just a project of 5 or 6 people, but it was in a context with all kinds of struggles for finite resources. And so the moment you have that,
yeah,
the moment you have competing agendas, competing priorities, competing interests, competing perspectives, you're going to have some degree of politics. You're right. Going to have varying kinds of politics. Of course, they can be more or less helpful. I think there are very few that go to the extreme of an assassin.
Yeah.
But you will have the politics. and let's also be really clear about what politics are. It's,
yeah,
it's about all the things that happen in an informal, unofficial, sometimes behind the way, that all of us engage in,
right,
to increase our power, to sell our ideas, to get things done.
Right, which is the interesting part, I think, which I found in the book as well. You know, you've kind of bifurcated politics into the good and bad. In my head, until now at least, it was an inevitable evil that can't be done without. And you even claim that, you know, good politics can be rewarding. If you can explain the difference between the two and, you know, highlight some of the benefits of good politics, because that's a very new term, probably for a lot of listeners as well.
Well, you're not alone, Shivam, when you say that, because, and I was certainly very much of the same opinion as you. Oh, politics, no, do me a favor, I'm going to run a mile.
Yeah.
I'm way too ethical, I've got way too much integrity, I'm too outspoken to engage in this nonsense, this Machiavellian toxic mess that is politics. I'm just here to do my job, I'm not here to play these ridiculous games.
Yeah.
And in that, I, like so many people, didn't understand that there is a spectrum of politics. If we understand that the informal and the unofficial and the behind the scenes is how we operate as human beings, then of course you have every right and every opportunity to choose not to get involved in the conversations that are not in the meeting but outside of the meeting, in the phone calls that are not standard and mandated but are helping get things done. You can totally choose to ignore those things. But I always say, well, then it's essentially like you're playing tennis, but on half the court. Okay, because in organizations, nice, the informal is as strong, and in highly politicized organizations, the informal is even stronger than the formal.
Yeah, I
agree. Of course,
agree.
The organogram means something. Of course, the delegations of authority and all kinds of decision rights mean something. They're not worthless. But they're not the full picture. The informal relationships and conversations and networks are as powerful, and like I say, in some organizations, even more powerful. So understanding what we're talking about is important. And then if you understand that we are talking about the informal relationships, the behind-the-scenes conversations, well, then, I mean, it stands to reason that, of course, those can be toxic and Machiavellian, abusive, exploitative, all kinds of things, you know, the kind of cloak and dagger stuff we all associate with politics. Or they can be perfectly legitimate. Hold on, I'm not getting enough traction here. I'm not getting enough airtime. I'm not getting enough understanding, enough support in the formal mandated processes and meetings. I need to try to shore up that support in other ways.
Right.
And interestingly, I was in a workshop a few weeks ago giving a lecture, and there was a delegate. And she said, you know, it's so interesting because I'm working for a manager who I so like. She's incredibly integrous. She's very good at her job. But I'm actually putting in an application to leave her team. So I said, well, that's intriguing. Tell me more. Yeah. And she said, well, it's because she is so adamant that she will not engage in the politics. She will not have conversations outside of the norm, that the work must speak for itself, and she's going to play strictly by the formal rules. And so she said, as much as I admire her, it's now getting to the point where I'm realizing she's not effective at all. She's not creating the air cover. She's not opening the doors. She's not making all the kinds of things happen that need to happen for us to be effective. And in this organization, which is highly politicized, it's not going to happen if you're not having those extra conversations behind the scenes.
But doesn't this hit this person who's not, you know, ready to engage into politics, doesn't it hit that person someday in the sense that it comes as a blow to the face? Doesn't that happen?
Sure. I mean, it came as a blow to my face when I realized how much I hadn't understood about politics. And look, I mean, I've had a very successful career. My first executive position was when I was 29. And so there's much that I've achieved and much that I'm proud of. And certainly there are times when I was really hitting my head against a brick wall and really finding things extraordinarily difficult. That wasn't ever because of the technical stuff. It wasn't because I didn't know the formal parts of my job. It was because something wasn't working in the informal relationships of support that I needed. Or conversely, the informal relationships of resistance that I wasn't navigating carefully enough, because I thought the formal authority and mandate that I had was enough.
Right. In fact, on that point, on that note, I have a very interesting line, or so to say, a small para from your book. I like to read it out. It goes as, there is strong evidence that our work ratings, bonuses, and promotions are weakly correlated to actual performance. In fact, performance may even matter less to our success than our political skills and how we are perceived by those who make the decisions. Niven, this is troubling to the ears.
Yes, of course it is. It's devastating.
Does my performance only matter so much? What I mean, this is really, please, I'd really like to hear from you on this.
Yeah, well, gosh, where do I start? Because I agree, I can hear the sounds of broken hearts in lectures and workshops when I say this often. And look, let's be really clear, I'm not a cynic. I don't wake up in the morning to feel a sense of disillusionment and disengagement with the world.
Right.
I think the world is wonderful, but I think we need to get far more pragmatic and empirical around how organizations actually work, rather than simply staying in the normative, inspirational, aspirational space of how we wish they worked. And so Jeffrey Pfeffer, in particular at Stanford Graduate School of Business, has written extensively on this. But the reality is that I think one of the biggest mistakes that most people make is that they think that their work will speak for itself.
Yeah.
I mean, if I had a dollar, a rupee, or whatever, for every time I've heard that in a workshop, no, I don't get involved in this because my work will speak for itself. To which I always say, guys, let's get real. Work does not speak. People speak. And so who is speaking about you, for you, with you, over you, around your work? And there's a fabulous book that I think has got a title almost as good as my book, which is from Kathleen Kelly Reardon in the States. She's an organizational psychologist. She writes a lot about politics. And her book title is called It's All Politics.
Yeah.
And then the subtitle is Winning in a World Where Talent and Hard Work Are Not Enough. And so I'm certainly not saying that they're not necessary. But they are not sufficient. And in fact, there is plenty of evidence that even with a really bad performance, and we have plenty of examples globally of CEOs who have destroyed companies, but they've had enough power, they've had enough support, that they've gone on to lead other companies. And so this idea, like I say, first of all, that your work will speak for itself,
that
is completely wrong.
Yeah.
And secondly, some of the most important decisions of your career are going to be made when you are not in the room. So again, you know, who is in the room for you and what are they saying? They're not going through the slide decks that you produced or the reports or the Excel models.
Right.
They're going on perceptions. They're going on relationships. They're going on recency of conversations and impression.
Right. Lovely. No, I just love the fact that, you know, how well you've put it, because people speak and work doesn't. And what people speak about your work is what matters. So it really clears the clouds around that. And you're right. I mean, decisions for you are taken in rooms where you're not there. So you definitely got to have a good, well-played politics field.
Yes, you've got to have enough allies and you've certainly got to minimize your adversaries.
But I think in that case, companies should start teaching politics, or universities should start teaching politics. I don't know. That's a crazy idea, but they should include that. So Niven, if I were to ask you 3 steps to start playing politics that can help me, that can benefit me, like you say, good politics, you know, which can propel my career towards success. Where do I start? How do I start on that?
So I think that the first step, and it sounds like a simple step, but it's actually the most fundamental and profound step, is to change your mindset, to change your worldview around this idea of politics, that it's an either or. Either I can play politics or I can be a good person, because of course politics are these hideous things. No, you have a range of options in how you can be effective, formally and informally. Now, how do you want to do that? And sometimes what I say to people is, look, if the word politics is so ingrained in your mind, and quite frankly, in your heart, as something that can only be negative, well then, you know, who cares what you call it? Call it whatever you want. Call it being effective in building my power base. Call it navigating stakeholders. Call it building networks of support.
Interesting.
But at its heart, it's always about the same 4 things. It's about the relationships that you have that will support you or will not when you need it. It's about the power that you have to make things happen. It's about the influence that you have, both formal and informal. And it's about the brand that you have, so how you are perceived. And those things are interdependent and multidirectional. So, as I say, you've got a range of options in how you use those things. Right. And understanding that there's much more to it than what most of us realize, I think, is the absolutely critically important first step, because it is a paradigm shift. And, you know, paradigm shift is an overused phrase. But when you actually do profoundly change your understanding 180 degrees, that's no small thing. So I think that's the first thing. Really get this into your head. How important it is, what the range of possibilities are, that you're not going to escape it, and that it's going to make a significant impact in your career, for better or for worse. Then the second thing is, once you've understood the what of politics and the so what, is I think to start to make this clear as to, well, where am I now? So most of my work is as a strategy consultant. And when I work with clients on strategy, it's about understanding where they are now relative to where they want to be. And then the strategy is the how.
Yeah.
How am I going to get from where I am to where I want to be? So you can't be clear on where you're going to end up or how you're going to get there if you're not sure where you're starting. So I think the second thing is then to be clear on, okay, so how am I showing up politically? And of course, you can get all kinds of feedback through 360s, through informal conversations, but also if people go to my website, there's a whole evaluation assessment that they can go through, multiple questions on multiple dimensions of political intelligence. And that's a useful way to just get a sense of, you know, how am I showing up and where am I relative to where I want to be? And then I think the third step is, once you're clear on, okay, so this is where I am now, is to come up with a political strategy that you really then spend the rest of your career implementing. And of course, it won't ever be one strategy. Strategies are contextual and strategies will change.
Right.
But in the workbook, similarly in the book, there's a series of exercises and questions to allow you to craft your political strategy. So in the context that you're in now, with the skills that you have relative to the skills that you want, in the position that you occupy relative to the position you may want to occupy, what are you going to do? Who do you need to get on board? Who do you need to try to keep close, because they might stop you? What are some of the things you need to start doing, stop doing? What are the things you need to focus on? What are the relationships you need to build? And these are things to which often I find delegates want very easy answers. And of course, strategy is never an easy thing, because you can miss some key things in a situation.
Right.
And it is always, always contextual. So there's no such thing as a best practice strategy. There's a best fit for purpose strategy. you have to understand what's going to be the best fit for purpose strategy for where you are now.
Right. And I think, like you said, the book has a lot of exercises and, you know, steps that you can go through to realize where you are and obviously what you need to do to get where you want to, which I think is really helpful for anyone who wants to go through that. They must, you know, pick up the book and use it because it's really helpful. In fact, I also use it for myself while I was reading the book for the conversation, but it quite helped me a lot as well. So, yeah.
That's so wonderful to hear. Things like that is what makes my day.
Great. Right. So another wonderful topic, I think, and very close to heart, obviously, for all the right reasons, is the salary negotiations and that you've touched upon in the book. Let us first hear from you as to what happened when you quoted your last run salary to a potential recruiter, which hurt you while it had nothing to do with what you get in the new role.
Yes. Well, I mean, it's so interesting how we all just take it for granted that when we're interviewed for a position,
right.
Even as, for example, in this case, when I was approached about the position, so I didn't apply, they asked me to interview. We don't think twice about the fact that they're asking us what our current salary is. And actually, if you think about it, it's crazy because my current salary is a function of many things.
Right.
It's a function of the organization that I'm in and its budgetary parameters. It's a function of the role that I'm playing. It's a function of all manner of things. So what I'm earning now, really, why does that have any bearing or relevance on this job? If you think I can do this job, what is this job worth? And therefore, you know, what is it considered to be paid?
Right.
And certainly there are a number of people who agree with me and then a number of HR people, no, that's not how it works. To which I just say, listen.
It doesn't work like that.
Yeah. I can understand you might need to verify some details.
Which is different.
But in my experience, exactly. In my experience, what happened there was something that I think happens all too often, which was that my salary was significantly less than it would otherwise have been. And it wasn't because I was going to do the job any less well or the job responsibility had suddenly shrunk. No, it was exactly the same. But the frame of reference that I was coming from, because I was coming from an NGO, was much lower than what was expected. And I've just gone through this experience now. Actually, I'm the chair of a board. Uh-huh. And we wanted to hire somebody, an FD. And I said, I know what he's earning now. What do we think the job is worth?
Right.
And it doesn't matter that it's 50% more than he's earning. He was working for an organization with a much smaller budget, but he is perfectly capable of doing this job. We've gone through four rounds of interviews, discarded multiple candidates. He's going to get the job at the price that this job is worth.
Right. Hope he's hearing this.
Yes, hopefully.
He'll be happy to hear that. No, great that you're not playing the same game which you have played. And you're
no.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, it is all... what is your benchmark and how much can we, you know, push up that benchmark where you're coming from is what how the HRs value the new job. I mean, it's nothing to do with what budget they come with, which is really weird after I read in the book, obviously, because it was normal before that.
Yes. Yeah, I must say I was very irritated. And I think, look, it does say something about the culture and the values of an organization that would do that, but it's right. Pretty standard. And it left nothing other than a very bad taste in my mouth. And quite frankly, I think too many organizations make that mistake. And then we do the same thing as candidates. We just take what's offered or we give away information that's not necessary.
Which is exactly what I wanted to ask you, right? How do I, you know, when I know I'm coming from, say I'm coming from an NGO or I'm coming from somewhere where I did not get paid as much, but I know that I'm capable for much more and the company is capable of paying me much more. How do I play this around? Because the HR is going to ask me that question. Any tips for that?
Yeah, so I think, look, it's interesting how this plays out, first of all, on a gender level, because there's a lot of research that says generally, and of course with all general rules, there are exceptions, but the general reality is that men are far more comfortable negotiating for their salaries than women are. And again, a lot of research that says the reason women earn less than men is because they negotiate less. Mm. And that then becomes a compounded thing over the course of their career.
It does,
so if
yeah.
you start and accept a lower salary from your first job, well, then you're behind already.
Yeah.
And that just gets worse through the course of your career. So I think there are real gendered differences around this and there are real perceptual differences. So, for example, research that comes out of Sheryl Sandberg's book, Lean In, is that women are not seen in the kind of positive light that men are seen in when they try to negotiate for their own salary. They're seen as greedy, they're seen as grasping, they're seen as ungrateful. What women are seen to be good at is negotiating on other people's behalf. So when women are saying, but you know, we should get more money for this group of people, well, that's seen to be acceptable. But for themselves, far less acceptable than a man stating his worth and saying that this is what I want to earn. So two practical tips for men and for women.
Yeah.
First of all, for women, I think the advice that Sheryl Sandberg gives is very apt, where she said when she was being recruited, I think it was for Facebook, may have been for Google, but one of the big roles that she had.
Yeah.
And she tells the story in the book of how she took the initial offer back to her husband. And he said, no, this is way too little. A man would be getting paid way more than this. She went back and she negotiated and she said, there's all kinds of evidence that women get paid less. There's all kinds of evidence that unless we start making structural changes, it's going to continue. So I need to start setting a precedent for women in this company.
Lovely.
And therefore, we need to negotiate a higher salary, first of all. And second of all, my role is to negotiate. How am I going to take on this role if I can't even negotiate for myself? So I think framing it is not just about yourself, but about something bigger, which for most women in most companies and countries is exactly the truth. I think works really well, both for women themselves and how they're perceived. And then I think the second thing is to be really clear on what your value is. I mean, we can all see when somebody's bluffing, unless you're a very good bluffer.
Yeah.
So what are the parameters? Having done your homework on the role, having spoken to people to the degree that you can, what do you understand the role to require? How do you understand it to be valued? And therefore, why are you worth it? You know, often that takes a degree of understanding and confidence, which quite frankly is not necessarily all that common, but it certainly is important. And so an example of how this played out with a delegate who came onto a workshop with me, he said, no, he was in an investment bank. And of course, those are very financially metrics driven. But he sat down, he told us all the story. He sat down with his boss at the beginning of the year and he said, okay, this is the bonus that I want. So what do I need to deliver to get that bonus? They had a whole conversation around it. It was very clear the number in his mind. It was very clear the steps to get there and off they went. Now, of course, in the context that he was in, the relationships that he had, the culture of this investment bank, that was completely acceptable. Unusual, but acceptable.
Yeah.
And so I think there are multiple ways to think about my value, to talk about it, to get out of this trap of just being grateful for and offer any offer, which so many people can fall into.
Hmm.
And sometimes you are just grateful for a job, in which case, put your head down, shut up, and be grateful for it. But if you have got some leverage and you have got some power to negotiate, not using that can cause a whole bunch of resentment. It's quite corrosive in the end.
Right. Really helpful. And I love how you've, you know, taken approaches both for men and women. So thank you for that. Great, Naveen. I think we touched upon a lot of topics today. Office politics, salary, and a lot of negotiation around it. And these are all very helpful, practical problems that we deal with every day. So thank you for that.
Oh, such a pleasure.
With that, I want to move to the concluding section, the last section of the podcast. The reason why we call the show Secrets of Storytellers is because I ask each one of my guests at the end of the show a secret about the book or maybe about the journey while you were writing the book that you've not really shared out in the open. So what are you sharing with us today?
I think the most notable secret for me is something that I will share with anybody who feels compelled or inspired to write their own book about something that matters to them. I have a very close friend who's written three books. And when I had a publisher speak to me about a book on office politics, I said to her, gosh, well, you know, I think I'm really going to jump at this opportunity. What a wonderful chance to get the word out to people I may never meet and will never meet in a workshop. And she said to me, what you don't understand, one thing you can't understand or anticipate around writing a book and getting it published is quite what a difference it makes to your own level of confidence and competence, both in how you see yourself and how you are seen. And I heard what she was saying, and she's my closest friend, so I trust her judgment enormously.
Right.
But I really couldn't understand what she was talking about, because I thought, you know, Helen, I'm not that short of confidence. And I'm certainly not low on the competence index either.
Right.
But having written the book, I understand there is something quite transformational about putting down words and experiences, seeing a finished copy, and then, you know, having experiences like this.
Right.
A person time zones away, a world away, who's read it and found value and resonance in it. I mean, beyond the joy and delight that it gives me, it does quite fundamentally change how you see your competence and confidence and how it is seen.
That is so nice. I mean, I've never heard that angle to writing a book. And I think that's very personal as well, which is so beautiful that you could share it with us. So thank you. Thank you so much, Niveen, for that.
My pleasure. Thank you for asking an interesting question.
Thank you. It was wonderful speaking to you. I hope you had fun discussing as well.
Yes, I absolutely did.
Thank you. Thank you. And for all the listeners, if you're intrigued by the book or by this topic, you can pick up the book. The link is in the details to this episode. We'll see you next time. Until then, this is Shubham signing off. Bye-bye.